This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 29. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
I think I mentioned it on our last podcast that I was moving all of my sites to a new host, and I finally finished up that process. I'd gotten everything over to the new host. I just hadn't actually redirected all the DNS entries. This podcast actually got moved as well, and I don't think anybody noticed. It was funny because I made the DNS entry changes, and it was maybe 5 minutes later when those changes went live, and you know everything started getting redirected immediately. So it was good to see that everything just kind of worked when I moved it all over.
Yeah, I didn't notice anything. I think you sent me an email that I promptly deleted when you're like, yeah, this day at this time, it's going to be switched over. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't matter to me. You know, as long as it stays up, who cares? I mean, even if it is down for 5 hours, like not that big of a deal because the audio is still served. Obviously, we serve it from a different server. Yeah, speaking of DNS, I'm always surprised at how quickly that goes. It's when I change it, it's always 5 or 10 minutes. And I know it takes a while to propagate across the whole internet, but the whole 24 to 36 hour thing, I have yet to see that actually be the case, you know, where people still hit the old site.
It really depends on how your DNS entries are set up and what you're looking at for your DNS server. So, like, I run my own internal DNS server, and that DNS server, if it doesn't have the domains that I'm looking for, it'll go out to, you know, out to the internet and start looking there. But if I hit a website, you know, one of my own websites, and then I change the DNS setting, I actually have to go in and flush my local DNS cache on that server. Otherwise, I won't see the changes.
Well, cool. For me, I've been sick. You can probably hear it in my voice, but we persevere nonetheless. These are the things we go through to bring the podcast to you. But you will notice me coughing and sneezing. I'll try to mute it when I can. And last week, I spoke at a .NET user group in. It's near Pasadena in Los Angeles. And that was pretty cool. It was just talking about, you know, turning your idea into a software product. It was a lot of fun. They had a big turnout. I was trying to figure out if it was because I tweeted it the day before. I was trying to figure out if it was the topic or if people, you know, some people came up and were like, hey, I've read your blog and I came because I knew you were speaking. But I don't know how much of an impact that had or didn't have. So nonetheless, it was fun. There was like, I don't know, maybe 30 people. And awesome questions, you know. I typically, for those types of things, I prepare like an hour of content and then have an hour of questions, and that's about what it worked out to. We were like pushed towards the end, even though I only had an hour worth of stuff. So that was fun.
Oh, I got to tell you about this cool thing I found for the iPad, since you have one.
Yes.
It's this application called MaxaVista. And apparently what it does is it allows you to set up a wireless network between your computer or your laptop or whatever and the iPad over Wi-Fi, and it allows it to act as another monitor.
How interesting. Oh, Scott, I see. Neat. Scott Hanselman uses it, I see. Is that where you heard about it?
No, I didn't hear about it there, but I did see a review from Scott Hanselman on it. So I had been specifically looking for something like this because I was like, why doesn't this exist? It seems, you know, intuitively obvious.
So you can actually use your iPad as a second monitor chained to your laptop or desktop.
Yep.
Is that right?
Oh, yep.
That's crazy. And it looks like it runs over Wi-Fi. Is that right?
Yep. Yes.
How insane. Huh.
So it's not particularly fast, and you probably wouldn't be able to use it for gaming or anything like that.
Right,
but
right.
To throw like your email over there from your laptop, or like if you're on the road or something like that, you know, it works pretty well so long as you don't have Wi-Fi network issues. I mean,
because
obviously that's the underlying thing that you got to rely on. And if you don't really have a lot of control over that, then you're kind of hosed. But I carry around with my laptop, I have a portable Wi-Fi hotspot. So I just carry that around. And if I ever need it, I can just pull it out and I've got my own. And I don't have to worry about anybody else stepping on my signal.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. Well, I'm excited about today's episode. Today, we're doing a throwback to the old days of 5 steps to X. You know, 5 steps to doing something. It's more of an educational show today. So the title of today's show is 5 Steps to Beating Your Startup Demons. And there's a pretty specific reason we're looking at it today. It actually stems from my experience over the past few weeks. I've talked with a few entrepreneurs, 2 or 3 folks, as well as I'm kind of sifting through my own plans and my own demons and trying to figure out the next thing that I'm going to do. And that thing may be a software product. It may just be a website. I'm experimenting with some like content websites and AdWords and just different kinds of models. I guess, you know, I tend to get bored doing the same thing over and over. So just building another site that's similar to what I already have sounds kind of boring to me. So I'm really experimenting and branching out. As a result, that something that I'm going to build is pretty amorphous right now. And it's actually been pretty hard. As a developer, I want to nail it down. You know, I'm analytical and I want to know what I'm doing, and I'm just struggling trying to actually find that what's next thing. So that's what we're going to talk about today. It's how to kind of get through these barriers and really how to get started and get started on your first set of actions. So we're going to run through a few strategies for setting yourself up with the proper mindset before you do anything. And then the last couple actually look at how to get started quickly. Both you and I, we're not super into motivational stuff, and we believe in goal setting, but it's like a lot of people trumpet it too much, I think. But I don't think it's cheesy to really lock down on some goals and to realize how important the right mindset is. Step one for beating your startup demons is to realize the difference between being a hero and a martyr. You want to talk a little about that, Mike?
Absolutely. One of the primary differences between a hero and a martyr is that people who think like a martyr really feel like they are the victim of everything. You know, the bad things are what happens to them, and it's always somebody else's fault. And the problem is that people who feel this way or think this way, you know, basically act that way as well. And they blame everybody else for their failures, or for the failures around them that lead to their position. And that has to stop. I mean, there's no two ways about it. That absolutely has to stop. You really need to stop blaming other people for the failures, either in your life or in your career, whether you have a job or whether you are looking for a different job because you hate the current one. You just need to stop blaming other people for it and really take responsibility and look at what it is that you want to do, establish your goals, and then go after them.
Yeah, we all know people who've been unhappy at their job for years. Maybe that's you, or maybe it's someone you know. There's no reason for this.
A lot of people being unhappy with it and not doing anything about it is really because they're fearful and they're afraid of making a change. And if you look at the list of the most stressful events that can happen in your life, they include things like a death in the family, getting married, moving, and changing jobs. And because of that, you know, because of all the stress that comes with getting a new job and finding a new job, there's all this fear around it. People don't like to change. So if you can get over that, then you can take that responsibility and stop acting like a victim. Stop acting like everything bad happens to you and you can't do anything about it. Because the fact is, you can do something about it. You just have to make the decision to do something about it.
Yeah, I think use the word victim, and I think that's totally synonymous with what we're saying here. We're using the word martyr, but victim is, you know, equally describes it well. And then the flip side of that, we said there's a difference between a hero and a martyr. So Mike was talking about a martyr. The hero is the person who takes control and says, this is my responsibility. They realize that it's within your power to change things, right? You have to believe that you have the power to quit your job and find another one, or to go out on your own if you want to become a consultant, or to launch a product if you want to, you know? You're in control of your circumstances. You don't get to where you are in life because of someone else. Other people may have small influences on you, but even your spouse or family members, they have the influence on you that you allow them to. And I wouldn't go so far as to say, you know, you should get a divorce if you don't agree with something your wife said, but you really have to, at times you're going to have to stand up to your spouse, and it may not be the most natural thing for you to do, and you just have to do it. I don't want to over-glorify the concept of the hero, but the hero is the person who makes stuff happen. Yeah, the bottom line is, you know, we keep talking about if you hate your job, because I think it's such a common thing. I mean, I think people are trying to get away from that a lot. And if you hate your job, you really have three options. You can either decide you're going to change something within the company, right? It's like political issues, and you're going to take control and seize it and make it happen. Or you're going to change something within yourself, meaning that it's an attitude thing, or you're somehow feeling something that you need to adjust, or you can change jobs. In my opinion, there should be no fourth option. The fourth option is not to stay at the job and piss and moan about how crappy it is and unhappy you are. That's not an option. Do not live like that. So So you have these three options. And I want to give you an example. And this is a bit of an extreme, but I changed jobs quite a bit because I was unhappy with things. And at first it took me some talking to by my, you know, by my dad and by my then fiance, because we weren't married, who basically talked me out because I was so unhappy at this very first job that I had. My dad had worked there for 35 years and I was slated to climb management. I'd been around there for, you know, since I was like 5 years old and had worked there since I was 16. And so I graduated from college. My whole plan is to be with this company. And I get there and I didn't like it. And it's an electrical contractor in the Bay Area. And I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it at all. And there was a 5-year management plan going on that I couldn't stand. You know, I just wasn't going to wait around 5 years to become kind of a peon manager guy. So I quit and it caused ripples. It was hard. There was fear. There was weeping and gnashing of teeth. I mean, there was everything you don't want. You know, it was definitely the hardest job I've ever quit. But eventually I did. And within a few months, I was way happier. And then within a year or 18 months, I was once again not enjoying salaried employment. This time I was a programmer and I really enjoyed that, but I decided to strike out on my own, start consulting. And then, you know, you all know the story. Another couple years later, I realized, man, consulting is like a hamster wheel. You're on a treadmill all the time. There's all these reasons not to do it. So I'm going to do products. And so what did I do? Did I stay handcuffed to my consulting desk and say, oh, but you'll pay me, you know, 3 figures an hour to write code? No, I mean, I made the break. So this is not, it was not easy. And I'm not tooting my own horn saying like, oh, it comes naturally to me, because it does not. And every time it's been scary and it's been a really hard decision. You know, at each step, I was unhappy enough and knew that a change had to be made.
So number two on our list is that you have to understand that getting started is hard for almost everyone. And there are basically three types of early stage struggles. The first one is fear of failure. And you have to realize that everyone has a fear of failure. And the problem is that nobody cares if you fail. That's something you really have to realize, because everyone's afraid that when you start doing something, if you fail, everyone's going to look at you and just like that guy from The Simpsons, he's going to scream, ha ha. But the fact of the matter is you have to get over it or you'll never do anything. And I should really rephrase a little piece of that. It's not that nobody cares whether you fail or not. It's that nobody's going to sit there and say, I told you so. I mean, people like to hear success stories, and the interesting thing is that people also like to hear stories of other people who have encountered failures and the things that they learned from them. So just keep in mind that getting started is hard for everyone, and the first of those three types of early stage struggles is the fear of failure, and that's something that everyone has to get over.
The second type of early stage struggle is a lack of direction, and this might be the most challenging one in the long term. Even after you start to beat down that fear of failure and not have it as much each time, and you're able to get over the third one that Mike's going to talk about in a second, this lack of direction is something I'm facing right now, actually, as I try to figure out what do I want to do next? Because you're in complete control of what to do. If you want to write a software app, then you need to find one that's going to energize you and be exciting and that hopefully has a market. You know, that's the idea. Or if writing a new app doesn't sound exciting, then what is next? This comes down to going back to your personal, almost your core values, and knowing what gives you life and what makes you excited. And I was actually talking to my brother last week about this thing, because I was kind of saying, you know, I'm really free to start whatever I want here. What should it be? And of course, he doesn't have specific insight into that, but he said, what makes you happy about what you're doing now? And what sounds exciting? And it comes back to this book I read called Strengths Finder 2.0. And this is going to sound so cheesy. I hate to say this stuff, but it really made an impact on me. Basically, Strengths Finder is where you take this test and it kind of tells you what you're strong in. So kind of the things that bring you life. And the premise of the book is that you shouldn't work to improve the things where you're weak, but you should just exploit the things that naturally give you life and that naturally you're really good at. You know, I have a couple strengths. I think everyone has three or four. But the one I think that's the strongest in me is learning, is being educated, always learning new things about whatever topic I'm involved in. And so that's where I am right now, is figuring out what's the next app. So knowing that helps me know that I don't just want to do a rehash of something I've already done, because that's not really going to teach me anything new. So as a result, I know that to be excited and to be interested in my next project, that for me personally, I'm going to have to find something that's pretty different. And with that, it's going to come some fear. You know, it's going to come more fear because I'm not reproducing something I've already done. But at the same time, in the long run, at least for, you know, a year or two, it's going to keep me excited and motivated.
Yeah, I think lack of direction is definitely one of those things that, you know, it's going to be an early stage struggle, but even after you get to the point where you're self-sufficient on your income and maybe you're working for yourself and you get to decide what it is that you want to work on, that lack of direction is still going to be pretty hard to overcome. I mean, unless you have that direction, I mean, you don't know what to do next.
Yeah, I agree. It's you bring up a good point that it comes back a lot. It comes back anytime you get to a point where you've kind of achieved a level of success. And I actually saw this with some successful software entrepreneurs at businesses software that I talked to. And some of them either were running very successful software companies and didn't even need to work a full work week. And then others had sold their companies for multiple millions of dollars and they were basically, you know, quote unquote set for life. And they're bored and they have a lack of direction now, and they're trying to figure out what's next for me that is going to give me life and excite me. And it's the same struggle that you will face if you first decide to leave your job, or if you first decide to just launch your very first product. It's exactly the same thing. You can't just decide to do it because it's going to make money. I mean, it really has to play into kind of who you are and your strengths.
Yeah, and that one little thing you threw in the end there is also really important, because if you hate your job enough that you want to quit and go do something else, once you've quit, you will have a lack of direction, because unless you put together a plan afterwards, I mean, you can really put yourself into a world of trouble if you didn't have a plan and a direction to go in after you quit your job, because let's face it, quitting your job was probably one of your goals. The third struggle you'll probably face is a lack of motivation or discipline. And one of the problems that a lot of people face is that escaping your job is simply not enough motivation. You need to want to move towards something, not away from something. And this is essentially a positive versus negative reinforcement mentality. And one of the best examples I can think of was at the Business of Software conference, there was a speaker who split the room into two groups, and he put a slide up on the screen. And on the left side, it said, clap if you want to win. And on the right-hand side, it said, clap if you don't want to lose. And he had split the room into two groups and said, you know, the people on the right-hand side followed the instructions on the right-hand side. People on the left-hand side followed the instructions on the left-hand side. And what we found was that the side that said, clap if you want to win, won by a fair margin. And apparently this is a very prevalent experiment that he's done in a couple of different places, and the result is almost always the same. And the point is that you need to want something to be motivated. Not wanting a specific outcome is simply not motivation enough.
Step three in beating your startup demons is knowing exactly what you need to get started. So you need two things. The first thing is you need education. And when we say education, we mean how. Let's take an example of like building a chicken coop. It's how to build that thing. It's having a high level knowledge of the task needed to accomplish that thing. So it's like having a blueprint for a chicken coop. Or if it's building software, it's having the high level knowledge of what it takes not only to build the product, but then to design the marketing and what steps you're going to take to, you know, are you going to collect emails and vaguely how you're going to do that? How are you going to launch? So it's kind of the high level viewpoints. And that's what we call education.
The second thing you need is the skills to actually get it done, and not just bits and pieces of it. I mean, basically step by step, everything that you need to know in order to get it done. For example, in Rob's example before, for building a chicken coop, can you cut a board? Can you hammer a nail? Basically, you need to know what is it going to take to succeed. And careful planning really just isn't enough. You need to make mistakes. And this is where prototyping comes into play. This is where doing things previously is going to help. Have you hammered a nail before, or do you just kind of know the conceptual things? And if you don't actually know how to do it, you need to do prototyping, and you need to make small test cases where you can get things wrong and it's not a big deal. So, for example, if you're launching a software product, do you know how to use MailChimp or some other mail list building software? Do you know how to do SEO? Do you know how to build a website? Can you actually put together the product, etc.? This is basically the difference between being an architect for something and being the construction worker who actually puts it together. You have to be able to do both.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is most blogs, this is actually something we've talked about before, but I call it the myth of blogs. And it's like most blogs don't talk at all about the skills. They either talk about the education, so kind of the high-level stuff, or even one step higher than that. It's like super vague, like the architectural astronaut type stuff. And that's actually a problem because really reading blogs gives you this high-level view of like, okay, I need to build a product and market it. And that's about as deep as it gets, you know, or maybe they'll say, yeah, doing an email list did this, but you still don't know all the tools. You don't know what the emails should say. You don't know the intervals you should send them. You don't know the times of day, the subject lines, the from email address. I mean, there's very specific things that really do have an impact on the success or failure of it. So not having the skills, but having the education is bad because then you think you know how to do things and you don't actually know. And then, of course, not having the education and only having the skills, well, that's kind of like a technician. You know, that's if you're just a developer, then you have the development skills and you don't really have the education to launch a full product. And I think that's the purpose of maybe podcasts like ours or of books and things like the Micropreneur Academy that we do. One thing I wanted to point out, I was thinking about, you know, as I was writing up this outline is it can get really confusing to follow a lot of different bloggers. And it's not that you can't casually read a lot of them, but oftentimes you'll see conflicting advice from multiple bloggers or podcasters. And there's a good reason for that. It's basically that different people have different goals based on, you know, their personal lifestyle goals or their goals of what they want for their product. So if you're reading Patrick McKenzie, who, you know, has Bingo Card Creator and is like the prototypical micro ISV, and then you're also reading Dharmesh Shah, you know, who's more of like the VC funded type stuff, and you're reading Jason Cohen, who's a bootstrapper, and maybe you're reading Mike, who I just coined this term, Mike. I don't know what you think about it, but I feel like you're an enterprise bootstrapper. You're a bootstrapper, but I think you're good at selling to the enterprise. I think that's kind of a neat moniker for you. and, you know, if you read my blog, I'm a micropreneur. It's like even Mike and I will likely contradict each other at times because, you know, we don't necessarily have the same goals with our products. So one thing I just wanted to kind of spit out there is that, A, I think following multiple people is okay as long as you figure out really who you want to model yourself after and really listen to them. And then the other people maybe use as peripheral information.
So the fourth step to beating your startup demons is to figure out what is the next step that you can take without actually writing code. And the answer to this is brilliantly simple. Don't write code. What you need to do is instead of writing code and trying to launch a product, what you need to do is find out if there's a market for the product before you actually go out and build something that nobody wants. You need to find out what your expectations are and level set them with reality. And you can do that using a variety of different methods, but you're basically just testing the market a little bit, see if people are interested in it. And if not, are they interested in something that's related? Because you might have this great idea for a product and you build something and it's related to something that people wanted, but not exactly the same thing. And then you've just wasted a ton of time and effort building something that people thought was interesting, but only because they wanted this little tiny piece of it and they wished that you had expanded that. So along with that, you have to find out what your goals are. And if the reality of the situation does not match your goals, you need to find something new. So if your goals are to build a $500,000 a year company, and it looks like the market for whatever it is that you're trying to build is, you know, maybe 100,000, then the reality does not match your goals. And you need to figure out whether, one, is that acceptable to you? And if it's not, you need to find something new. You know, you need to come up with another idea, or you need to figure out how can you tweak your idea or address a different portion of the market to be able to bring those things into alignment. And if you can't, then you do need to move on and you need to find something new.
Yeah, I think an example of this is an entrepreneur I met with about 6 weeks ago. And I won't say what his product was, but I'll use a hypothetical, but it was basically, let's say it was like scheduling software for dry cleaners or something like that, you know, where they enter orders and such. And up front, he had spoken with some people and done kind of some business planning, and it had given him the impression that this was a huge market, like that he could go out and raise angel funding and venture capital, and that this is going to be like a $20 million business or a $100 million business or something. And the first time he told it to me, I thought, man, that's a great niche. You know, I told him that. And then the more we talked, I said, yeah, I could see it being six figures a year, maybe low seven figures. And it, like to him, it just kind of was a real reality check. And of course, that was only my opinion. I actually hadn't done a lot of research into it. But the more research I did, the smaller I realized this market is. Yes, there are a lot of dry cleaners, but reaching them and convincing them to change to your system is horrendously expensive, right? There's a lot of things in your way. So it's not that his product idea is bad. It's that his expectations were so far off and he hadn't spent the time up front to really, you know, look into that, or didn't have the knowledge, I should say, up front to kind of level set his expectations, as you said. And then step five for getting over your startup demons is figuring out what can you do now, right? What can you do given what you have? This comes back to the hero versus martyr thing. I receive at least one email a month, and luckily, I'm glad it's that few, but I receive at least an email a month from someone who's telling me, I'm a developer, I don't have time because I work 70 hours, and I don't have any money. Like, I don't have spare money to hire a developer or to hire a designer. What can I do? And I typically email them back and say, you can do nothing. If you really believe that, if you really don't have money and time, then you can't do anything. But here's what you should do. And then I tell them, if you're a developer and you're not making enough money, then you're either being underpaid or you're pissing a lot of money away on things that you should not be spending it on. You know? And again, it's none of my business until you tell me you want to start a company and you're asking my advice. And then it is my business. That's the advice that I would give you. You know, you can spend your money on whatever you want. But if you're unhappy that you spend $100 a month on your cable bill and you bought a Beamer and you spend $500 a month on that car payment and you overpaid for your house and, you know, there's all these other things and it sucked up your whole salary, well, then you need to make changes, and those changes may hurt. You know, it may require selling the Beamer. It may require selling stuff on Craigslist, eBay, whatever it takes. And that's what it comes back to, is looking at your life and saying, what can I do now to make things happen? You can always find some time. You can drink caffeine and you can stay up at night. That's how I got started. You can sell stuff on Craigslist and get by for just a few more months after you quit your job. I also did that. You either need time or you need money or you need both to get this started. So if you have a lot of time, then yes, you should do a lot of stuff yourself. If you have not a lot of time and you have more money, then you should outsource a lot more stuff. Now, Mike and I always encourage people to learn to outsource early. It will almost always multiply your time, and it will, you know, you'll be better in the long run. Ultimately, this step five here is to figure out what you can do now, even if it feels drastic. If you really want to do this, you'll suck it up and you'll make it happen.
It's funny that you laugh every time you say selling stuff on Craigslist, but I literally, within the last month, I've sold about $2,000 worth of stuff on Craigslist.
Yeah, and I sold almost $1,000 worth of stuff on eBay this month. I mean, it just happens every once in a while. I know. I do laugh because it feels cheesy, but like a lot of entrepreneurs I know do this. You know, you go through once a year and you have a lull time maybe. I mean, that's what I've had for the past month. And so you just kind of dig through your stuff and then you figure out what to sell. And it's worth it, especially if you have a lull and it brings in some cash. I mean, there's always ways to get it done.
So what have we got for listener questions? They're starting to stack up a little bit, but I think we can bang through several of them at this point, right?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. The first question we have is from Joe Rawlinson. And he said, he asked a question specifically of me. And he said, did you self-publish your book, Start Small, Stay Small? Located at startupbook.net. If so, what service do you use for printing and fulfillment? It totally was. Yeah, startupbook.net running a special this week. No, I'm just kidding. So the answer is yes, I did self-publish my book. I was in talks with a couple publishers and decided to go self-publishing. Gave me a lot more control over the formats that I could use, as well as knowing that I had an audience that would be interested in the book. It made more sense to do it that way. Also, since it's such a tight niche, I wanted to laser focus this book to really be just for developers who wanted to start startups. And the publishers were not excited about that. They wanted, you know, it has to sell more copies. So they wanted me to genericize it. And they actually wanted me to include a lot of stuff about mobile apps and not go, you know, so detailed with stuff. So that's the reason I did it. The printer that I use is createspace.com, and they are owned by Amazon. Amazon bought them within the last year, 18 months, so they have a pretty tight integration there, and I highly recommend them. They're a lot cheaper than Lulu. I think the per copy price is half of what Lulu is, and it might even be like 40% of what Lulu charges per copy. So I highly recommend them, and it's been a good experience. Question number two is about SEO and blogs on a subdomain, and this is from Paul Yoder, and he says, I'm launching a product written in Ruby on Rails, and I want to have a blog to help drive traffic to the product site. I want to use WordPress as a blog engine. I will need to have the blog on a subdomain. Okay, this is the kicker here. My question is, well, having the blog on a subdomain, and he points out blog.product.com, will that hinder the amount of traffic driven to my site compared to having the blog in a subdirectory, meaning product.com/blog? How will SEO be affected? Okay, SEO will be majorly affected. Subdomains are viewed as completely different websites from Google. So if you get links coming into your blog domain, they will not help your company domain at all. So I would highly, highly recommend going with the /blog. You also ask about traffic, like how will traffic be affected? If you have links in the header, I don't think it'll affect any users clicking through from either way, right? From your blog to the product site or product site to the blog. But really, SEO is majorly impacted by this. So I only recommend using subdomains under very specific circumstances, and this is not one of them. So Paul, hopefully you're able to put that blog in a subdirectory and not the subdomain to keep your SEO strong.
So the last question that we have is actually a call that came into our voicemail number. Rob, you want to go ahead and play that for the listeners?
Sure.
Hi, I wanted to say I love your podcast. It's plenty of useful information and lots of it. I just wanted some tips on how to hold a client's hand, especially getting into the technical areas of development schedules, wearing a lot of hats, designing, developing. How do we hold the client's hand? If you have any tips on that, that'd be great. Thank you.
So this sounds more like a generic, how do I be a good consultant for my customers question. Interfacing with the customers is one thing, but this question I think comes up a lot more in smaller consulting companies where you are one person and you've got to talk to a bunch of different people. For example, you have to be able to talk to some of the higher level executives, and you've got to be able to talk to the technical people at the end who are actually helping you implement stuff. And you need to be able to interface with both without necessarily destroying your credibility as a consultant. And what you have to keep in mind is you have to address them differently. You have to really think about what it is that those people are interested in and specifically talk to those interests. Now, some of the interests between management and the technical people are going to overlap, and some of them are not. So when you're in discussions with the technical people, leave out the business drivers. If you're in discussions with management, leave out the technical pieces of whatever it is that you're talking about. Speak their language. And that's very, very important. And it can be difficult to do that, but there are training classes out there that you can go to. I mean, personally, I've gone through two different training courses that were each about a week long that were basically, how do you be a good consultant? And it was all about how to address problems, how to talk to different levels of management, how to talk to specific problems, how to talk to the financial and contractual aspects of whatever it is that you're working on. There's a lot of things that are involved in dealing with clients that most people just don't think about when they're doing consulting, because most people don't get training on that sort of stuff. And, I do enterprise sales, so I've been through that stuff and I have to be able to do it. But when you're working with smaller companies, it can be very difficult to try and differentiate yourself in many of those different roles, because you have to do all of them at the same time. You have to be the sales guy. You have to be the support person. You have to be the technical person who gets the things done. And you can really very easily pigeonhole yourself as a person who is just technical or can't really talk to the executives or tell them exactly why it is that they're buying stuff. And that makes it difficult to run your business in the long term, because as you start working with these different customers, they kind of pigeonhole you into a specific type of role. And unless you have a larger company where you've got multiple people that you can throw at a client, you know, that's just going to happen. And unfortunately, as you grow out your consulting company, you'll have one person doing sales, another person doing marketing, another person doing technical stuff. And, you know, chances are at some point you'll have an engagement manager of some kind who manages multiple consultants and basically is making sure that everything is going well for the customers. But it can be difficult when you're a one-person shop or two- or three-person shop because you have to wear all of those different hats and you don't want to confuse the customer over what exactly is your role there. And you just have to make sure that you're aware conceptually of what the people you are talking to are interested in and, you know, make sure you're addressing their needs and concerns appropriately.
What he said.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.